Hello, and welcome to Seen and Unseen Aloud. It's great to have you with us. This week, Seen and Unseen Aloud turns a year old. Every week for a whole year, we've heard from all sorts of contributors and discovered Christian perspectives on just about everything. Whether you're listening for the first time or been with us since the beginning, we're so glad you've joined us. To celebrate our birthday, we're inviting requests for a special birthday compilation episode. So if you have a favourite article that you've heard, please head over to our website, seenandunseen.com, where you'll find a quick form to fill in to submit your request. We'd love to know more about where everyone is and what you're doing while you're listening to us. Maybe you're doing the washing up or going for a walk. We'd love to get a picture of our Seen and Unseen community, so there are a couple of questions about that too. Please submit requests by Tuesday the 12th of March. And then we'll be ready for going live on Monday the 18th of March. For now, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, get ready to listen, to discover the seen and unseen. What Bobby Brazier, Joe Marsh and Eleanor Rigby have in common, by Belle Tindall. Loneliness. It's a part of life. Let's talk about it. That's the new slogan offered by the NHS in partnership with the Department for Culture, Media and Sport. As part of their campaign, they recently invited young influencers and TV personalities to Downing Street to do just that, to talk about loneliness. With those aged between 16 and 29 now twice as likely to report feeling lonely as those over 70, these celebrities were tasked with answering a few of the questions most asked by people within that age group. Their questions went along these heart-wrenching lines. Why am I so lonely? Is it normal to feel lonely? Will I always be this lonely? And while their answers to such questions were a little meh, whose wouldn't be? They were given 7 seconds to answer some of humanity's deepest questions. It doesn't much matter. Their answers weren't really the point. Rather, viewers were presented with a handful of popular, successful, lovable, looking at you, Bobby Brazier, and happy-looking people doing something notoriously difficult. Admitting loneliness. And I think that may be the point. I'm of the firm opinion that admitting to feeling lonely is one of the hardest things a person can do. I have certainly never had the bravery to do it. I remember watching Greta Gerwig's 2019 adaptation of the beloved 1868 novel Little Women for the first time. I was always going to love it. I decided as much before even stepping foot in the cinema. But there was one scene that felt as if it literally took my breath away. I was left winded in row C. It's towards the end of the film, and Joe Marsh, the feisty, strong and independent protagonist, is giving a feminist monologue for the ages, albeit to her mum, as she stands in the attic of her childhood home. Joe speaks of women's minds and souls, their ambitions and talents. She explains how sick she is of being underestimated, getting more impassioned with every word. That is, until she tearily ends her speech by declaring, "But I'm so lonely." This isn't in the book. This final line was written by Greta Gerwig specifically for this adaptation. The only person who seemed to be more taken aback by Joe's words than me, an owner of more editions of the novel than it is cool to admit, was Joe herself, who instinctively clasped her hand to her mouth as if she couldn't believe that she just said such words out loud. As far as filmmaking goes, it was genius. As far as human nature is concerned, it was, well, true. Not only do we find loneliness acutely painful, but we also tend to find it near impossible to admit to. So much so, the government currently feels the need to step in. Why is that, I wonder? Why does lonely seem to be the hardest word? Part of it is certainly because there's a social stigma attached to feeling lonely. Ironic, isn't it, how loneliness has social connotations. Nobody wants to be Eleanor Rigby, nor Father Mackenzie, nor any of the lonely people that Paul McCartney so pities, for that matter. It's one of the only Beatles songs you wouldn't want to have been written about you. Loneliness feels like a failure somehow, so we struggle to admit it, even to ourselves. A failure because we're supposed to be self-sufficient, independent, free-thinking, emotionally sturdy individuals, which is the operative word, of course. That's what individualism has taught us, isn't it? And so how do we reconcile that with the piercing pain of isolation? How do we admit that there's a deep crack within us that can't be papered over by success or wealth or another episode of our favourite podcast? How do we go about admitting such a lack? A lack which, despite individualism's best efforts, has us naturally wondering why it's there in the first place. Are we unpopular, unattractive, unlikable, or worst of all, unlovable? Those who admit to their own loneliness are wading into profoundly vulnerable waters, and most of us are utterly unwilling to follow them there, lest we be spotted by budding Paul McCartney and our loneliness be immortalised. And then, of course, there's the other side of the coin. What does our loneliness say about the people who we are in relationship with? Nobody wants to unleash the panic and guilt tucked away in that can of worms, which, I must note, is unnecessary panic and guilt. There could be any number of reasons why you're feeling lonely, despite your very rich relationships. And so we just don't say the word. And that's what appears to be making the NHS and, rather randomly, now I think about it, the Department for Culture, Media and Sport so nervous. We need to admit when we're lonely. We have to pull a Joe Marsh and say it out loud. We must give language to the lack that we feel. One of the things I find myself most consistently thankful for when it comes to my Christian faith, you know, apart from the most obvious aspects, is that it gives me such language. At the risk of sounding annoyingly self-centred, it dignifies the feelings that I find hard to even acknowledge. It offers explanation and therefore a comfort that I could never find anywhere else. A comfort rooted in truth. It may sound nuts, but I have come to understand the reality of loneliness, not through influences on a sofa in Downing Street, although that's great, and not even through Joe Marsh's monologue, which is even greater, but through an ancient Hebrew poem. This poem tells me that to be alone is not good. Not good. Not right. Not as it should be. That's God's point of view, at least. That to be alone, properly, completely, and permanently alone, goes against the very fabric of the world. It is at odds with human flourishing. I've come to deeply value how concrete that is. I've also learnt to relax into the knowledge that not only is loneliness normal, referring to one of the questions referred to at the beginning, it's natural, in every possible sense of the word. To be known and loved is my deepest and truest need. I was designed for relationship with God and with people. And therefore, with all the complex ways that life unfolds, to be lonely is to be human. So, with all of this in mind, I'm tempted to end where we began, to come full circle and once again borrow the government's words. Loneliness. It's a part of life. Let's talk about it. Politics Needs Some Deep, Stirring Emotion by Henrik Hundill. The government you elect is the government you deserve. So goes the famous quote variously attributed to Thomas Jefferson, Joseph de Maistre, and George Bernard Shaw. Of all these thinkers, Maistre is perhaps the most interesting, describing the business of government as a kind of religion, a political faith, one complete with dogmas, mysteries, and even ministers. Maistre was somewhat surprisingly, amid the turmoil of the 18th century France, a staunch monarchist. His argument was that if the authority of a political leader was only a product of social convention, then that authority would always lack a sufficient degree of legitimacy, leaving the door wide open for violence and strife. His solution was to defend the divine right of kings. This was a controversial position, as much then as it is now. Aside from his famous quote about elections, Maistre's political philosophy is oft criticised as polemical, harkening back to a golden era of European monarchy that never really existed. Nevertheless, within his writings, Maistre laid bare a reality that we often prefer to keep veiled, that our political will is as much about what we find to be emotionally compelling as it is about what we find to be rationally convincing. Indeed, the latter is very much dependent on the former. The more social scientists are able to demonstrate the reality of subtle phenomena such as confirmation bias, unconscious bias, and racial prejudice, the more we see that we are often being governed by precognitive or non-cognitive instincts, even those of us who like to think that we are better than that. In the end, we have to concede that when it comes to politics, as with so much else, the struggle between our faculty of reason and the desire of our heart is a fair fight. In 1930s Europe, there was certainly a lot of emotionally compelling politics around. Fascinated by the language and culture of the German people, thinker and educator Amy Buller made repeated visits to Germany from the 1920s onwards, often accompanied by reading parties of British academics, church leaders, and university students. In those decades, as the political landscape of Germany began to shift, her purpose became less about countryside walks and studying, and more about the facilitation of urgent, open, and honest dialogue between Buller, her fellow travellers, and their German counterparts in the churches and universities where she had contacts. As Hitler rose to power, and even before the full horrors of Nazism became widely known, Amy was compelled to find out why so many people, especially young people, were being attracted by what she saw as a brutish ideology. In 1943, amid the violence and destruction of World War II, Buller published a book, Darkness Over Germany, which gives a first-hand account of the many people that she and her travelling parties had met and the conversations that had taken place. Like Maistre, Buller proposed that without God, politics was a dangerous kind of faith in something, one that tended towards violence. In the introduction to her book, she writes of the tragedy of a whole generation of German youth who, having no faith, made Nazism their religion. It's common these days to hear complaints about the political apathy of the young, with polls commonly reporting that only about 50% of British 18 to 24-year-olds are intending to vote in the next general election. However, there are those who raise the caution that this may not be a symptom of apathy so much as a symptom of the cultural and structural injustices that put barriers in the way of young people engaging with our nation's political life. Young people are not likely to believe in a political system from which they feel excluded. As Buller's writing notes, when this happens, young people are likely to put their faith in something else. Maistre's solution was perhaps too extreme for modern sensibilities, asking the politically minded populace to believe that their leaders were imbued with the authority of God, by God. In the 20th century, Buller made a more moderate view. As the Nazis began to view her with suspicion, trips to Germany became increasingly difficult to arrange, so she travelled elsewhere, to places such as Hungary and Bulgaria. Wherever Buller went, she found more and more young people who wanted to talk to her about their political hopes and ideals. Summarising the whole, Buller suggested that Europe's political landscape was eschewing shallow rationalism and instead being shaken by a deep stirring of emotion, particularly among young people. She recorded the observation, "They all want change, and they all want a chance to play a part in that change, but so few have any religious faith, which means that they have few standards by which to judge between falsehood and truth in revolutionary movements." In a recent report published by the Jo Cox Foundation, increasing the public's political literacy was highlighted as a key response to prevent the outbreaks of abuse, intimidation and violence towards elected officials. As any educator will tell you, literacy is a two-way street. It includes not only the shallow rationalism of knowing information or knowing where to access information, but also the ability to communicate that information effectively to others. Such communication comes from a much deeper, embodied kind of knowing, one which requires one to have assimilated knowledge and worked with it, feeling its malleability and testing its apparent truth claims against an internal standard of what is true or false or wrong and right. For Buller, this internal standard was inextricably linked to faith. To the end of her life, she remained open-minded as to what form this faith might take, albeit her own religious practice was firmly Christian. Cumberland Lodge, the educational charity she set up to promote her aims, was from the start open to those of all faiths and none, and she warmly welcomed dialogue between those of different faith groups, including atheism. But in 1943, as Amy Buller looked with hope towards the prospect of a post-war Europe, she summed up the political landscape as follows. "We are now faced with the greater task of bringing healing to the nations, including our own. I am convinced this cannot be done without a faith in God adequate to the tremendous task of reconstruction." Given Amy Buller's open-mindedness, one can read the word God in this statement in its broadest possible sense, as referring to whatever moral compass one takes as an internal standard of what is true and false, or wrong and right. But the point remains that the political will is therefore not a matter of rational thought, or not only of that, but it is an expression of feelings and instincts that run far, far deeper. Misreading the Moment at Weddings by Jonathan Rowlands. Petitions are 10 a penny these days. Seems that everyone and their dog wants you to sign their petition. They run the gamut from intensely serious call a general election now to downright daft. Deport Erling Haaland on the grounds that he's not human. I nearly signed that one. It can be very easy, then, simply to see every new petition as yet another drop in the increasingly large ocean of people demanding change that'll likely never come. I was, however, struck by one petition I saw recently entitled "Improve Working Conditions for Wedding Video/Photographers in Churches." Launched by photographer Rachel Whittaker, the petition details the harassment faced by wedding videographers and photographers in the course of their jobs, documenting one of the most important days in the lives of happy couples. Who could possibly be harassing wedding photographers? Demanding couples? Disgruntled in-laws? Drunken uncles? Nope. Vicars and ministers of the church. This particular petition struck me because I'm in the unusual position of having some insight into both sides of the dispute. In my day job, I'm a theologian and biblical scholar who trains people entering ordained ministry as clergy. But I've also been a semi-professional photographer who has been the sole photographer for a number of weddings. I can, to some degree, Sympathise with both groups. Let me start off by saying something about being a wedding photographer. It is unbelievably stressful. Although I've had a fairly comfortable life, it has not been without moments of stress. I've moved house, planned a wedding, failed and later passed driving tests, prepared for my PhD examination. I even lived through Liverpool's 2005 Champions League final in Istanbul. But none of these compares to the stress of being the sole photographer for someone's wedding. Weddings are full of irreplaceable moments. The bride only enters the church once. There is only one exchange of vows, or first kiss, or first dance, or set of speeches. As a photographer, if you miss them, you miss them. What if your memory card stops working, or the files corrupt, or the focus is just out of focus enough for the bride to be a bit blurry, or that uncle steps in front of you just as the first kiss happens? Tough luck. No happy memories for you. What photographers don't need, then, is clergy making their lives even harder. Again, unfortunately, I can speak from experience here. At one wedding I photographed, the vicar told me I could only take photos from behind the last pew. But I left my telescope at home. Another said I couldn't use a camera with the shutter noise. I guess I'll just take the pictures with my mind then. Yet another told me I couldn't use a flash because it would damage the old brickwork of the church walls. I'm still trying to work that one out. Yet, as a theologian, I kind of get it. Because marriage is a sacrament. Marriage is not simply a commitment between two people to love each other for the rest of their lives, or at least that isn't all it is. Instead, marriage is also an outward sign that points to an inward reality in our lives. Marriage is also a performative reenactment of the way in which Jesus loves the world. In the Gospels, Jesus is asked why his disciples don't fast like some others do. He responds, "The wedding guests cannot fast when the bridegroom is with them, can they?" At the end of the Bible, in the book of Revelation, we learn who it is that Jesus is marrying: the bride, the holy Jerusalem, a city filled with Jesus followers. This is whom Jesus is set to marry. Human marriage points to and is grounded in this marriage between Christ and those whom Jesus loves. It is not a literal marriage, lest we wade into some very sticky theological territory. We are not to understand this marriage in the same terms as human marriage. Rather, we are to understand human marriage with reference to this marriage between Jesus and the ones he loves. All this is to say that marriage is intrinsically meaningless. Please note to my wife, please keep listening. This isn't to say marriage is meaningless. Instead, I mean that marriage is not done for marriage's sake. It points to something outside of itself, and in doing so, marriage finds its meaning. It has, in other words, extrinsic rather than intrinsic meaning. Marriage is grounded in something outside of marriage, Jesus' love for the church. And so when clergy get a little frustrated when they perceive photographers and videographers to be imposing upon marriage services, I get it. None of this is to say that aggression from clergy towards people doing their job is ever warranted. It's not. There's never an excuse for that. But for clergy, the frustration underpinning this emerges, I hope, from a perceived lack of respect towards what is really happening in the marriage service. In the moment of joining two people to each other, the marriage service points towards Jesus' love for his church, and that simply can't be captured by the photographer. Something more important than any picture is happening here. The people exchanging vows are being made into a living embodiment of Jesus' love for the church. Of course, It is not only in marriage that Jesus' love is displayed. Jesus himself wasn't married. It's likely the Apostle Paul wasn't either. They both did a decent job at embodying the love of God, even if Paul did so in a slightly shouty way from time to time. None of this is to say that marriage is the only way where Jesus' love is displayed in human lives. Let's return, for example, to the dispute between clergy and wedding photographers. Sure, some photographers might intrude upon wedding services in ways that downplay the magnitude of what's happening. However, to respond with aggression and abuse is a bigger affront to the love of God from members of clergy who really ought to know better. Instead, clergy might consider such moments an opportunity to display and embody the very love that the marriage service itself seeks to point towards. The love of Jesus is only detracted from and not embodied when clergy begin to overreact to those employed by the human bride and groom to capture the events of the day. They may well be ways in which clergy, photographers and videographers can work together to better preserve and capture the sacred nature of what is being pointed towards in the marriage service. This cooperation will always be a better embodiment of Jesus' love for the church than any needless antagonism. Clergy would also do well to remember that photographers can use Photoshop. Upset them at your peril.
Thank you for listening. Remember to subscribe to this podcast to get more curated articles from Seen and Unseen Aloud. We hope you discover a world that is greater, more full of meaning and sense than you ever imagined.